ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The world right now is a disaster. It's easy to feel helpless. But there was a moment when millions of people around the world said enough. I'm Sisonkim Simong. Join me for Boycott, the fight to end apartheid, how Australians joined others around the world to push back against racism and won.
Whites only teams, we thought that to the average Australian, that would be despicable.
Boycott, the fight to end apartheid. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, Hamish, when Twitter and social media burst into our world, they were seen as a great opportunity, a beacon of hope for democracy.
Remember the so-called Twitter revolutions, the start of the Arab Spring?
These were tools to allegedly liberate, to empower citizens, to challenge autocracy, maybe even give birth to new democracy.
So what happened? Why did it turn out so differently? And does AI pose a bigger challenge altogether? Can we even measure what this vast, powerful new technology is doing to our democracies?
I'm Geraldine Doogue.
I'm Hamish McDonald. This is The Matter of Facts, a mini-series about disinformation from Global Roaming.
Yeah, you know, it is really interesting to think back to those Tahrir Square and all the Arab Spring, Hamish. And, I mean, I was obsessed with the fact that they had no idea how to channel all of that big citizen revolt into something like political parties. And I know that was right. But actually, what you've been exploring is another aspect altogether.
Yeah, totally. But I actually think a lot about that period of time now. Like, I was sent to cover the Egyptian revolution. I was in Libya. It was this immense moment of opportunity. Like, the world was swept up in this idea that social media could bring down dictators.
Because it could get people out on the streets.
Yes, but it could also allow them to coalesce around ideas, you know. But the other part of it that I'm reminded of is the language that we now hear from democratic leaders, which echoes in my mind what we heard from the likes of Mubarak in those final stages.
President Mubarak, the former president of Egypt.
Yeah, and the description of what was floating around on social media as misinformation, as disinformation, as fake news. You know, this was the language that was coming out of those dictators at the time when the message was being democratized, as it were.
Yes. There was a sort of an innocence, I think, that everybody would come out.
A naivety,
and,
maybe.
Yeah, I think that, tragically, I've thought a great deal about it. And of course, it basically really led to the shocking Syrian civil war for years and years.
Well, also,
it accompanied it, shall we say.
The skills, the attributes, the drive that enabled people to lead Twitter revolutions were not necessarily the same skills that were required to lead a nation on the other side of toppling a leader.
That's exactly
what happened
right.
In Egypt. You know, you have these figures that emerge.
And Tunisia was the same.
As leaders of revolutions, effectively, but then they have actually no political nous, they have no platform, and instead you get the Muslim Brotherhood coming in and taking control, and then the military coming back in over the top of that and taking control again. But on this episode of our Matter of Facts mini-series, we are going to try and interrogate this question of whether and to what extent AI, mis and disinformation, is undermining democracy.
Well, you have a fascinating example, which persuades even me, a skeptic, from Indonesia in your part two, Hamish, of your television series.
Yeah, so just to set this up, Ben Strick is an Australian. He was an investigator with Bellingcat. You might have heard before. They've done a lot of the work to sort of uncover Russia's role in Ukraine, the downing of MH17, just one of many examples. Ben now investigates, I guess, the kind of cyber trail of mis and disinformation. And he's presented me as part of this TV series with a really fascinating example. Just to our north in Indonesia, it relates to some messaging that was rolling out on social media around West Papua. And I'm interested that you were persuaded,
Terry. I was. I was. I thought it was very disturbing. I just thought it was clear cut. They are taken down.
He identifies the source
he does,
of the disinformation.
And Meta and them, or whoever it was, it took them off the net. Now, I was thrilled to bits to hear that.
Here's how Ben explains it.
The thing is, we saw Indonesian accounts sharing videos like this. What is Indonesia trying to hide in West Papua? It's trying to hide its great budget decisions, its great work with schools and things like that. And it was actually being shared by accounts like this guy called Marco267. But it's kind of odd for me because it's not only Marco uploading it, it's hundreds of accounts all posting the exact same message. So let me take you back to Marco267. Now, I do something like an image reverse search on his profile picture.
Yeah.
Marco looks like a friendly Western white guy. I collected time codes of Marco's posting activity and his friends. And you can see this repeat pattern. Bella Now, one of his friends, is posting at 0:32:56, 9:32:56, 8:32:56. They're posting on a pattern. Mm-hmm. These are bots. And simply doing an image reverse search, I'm able to find that person's LinkedIn account. And now we've identified a company. That company owns all of these websites, this one marketing firm in Indonesia.
Yes, I just thought, wow, that was a very cogent, you know, sequential proof that he offered. And you thought, I did think to myself, how much more of this is happening? Deeply unscrupulous, of course. Deeply unethical. Horrible stuff, isn't it?
But one of our allies. We've just signed a security pact with them.
But, I mean, it certainly does alert one to, the old argument was follow the money. Well, yes, that'll still be true in this new era, but it'll also be sort of follow the particular political idea, I suppose. You can see the challenge.
Let's introduce you to our guest now. Constanza Sentwaiza is a senior lecturer in comparative politics at the ANU. She's been researching this specific question, the relationship between AI, disinformation and democracy. She's been looking at democratic backsliding and the impact of artificial intelligence. Here she is. Constanza Sentwaiza, welcome to Global Roaming.
Thank you for having me.
I want to get into the research you're doing, but what's actually caught my eye is that there's very little actual research, empirical data, on what AI is doing to democracy to begin with.
That is true, because it is a relatively new phenomenon, and we just had the super year of elections happening, unfolding while these new technologies were deployed. And so we are just collecting data and trying to understand how this is affecting the information, how it's affecting political behavior and people's perceptions of elections as well.
So we talk a lot about how harmful mis and disinformation can be. I'm interested in the context of democracy. Is it more threatening? Is it the most threatening you've seen it? Like, how much is it impacting democracy?
Well, that is a very interesting question. I mean, disinformation and misinformation are not a new phenomenon, but just now we have these new technologies that can facilitate the deployment and distribution of information or disinformation at a massive scale. So this is amplifying problems that we already had. When we look at indicators of democracy from around the globe, and this is data that was just published last week from the Varieties of Democracy Index, we can see that government censorship of the media, freedom of speech, media bias, they are all heavily affected by these new technologies. And so it's having a major impact on our democracies worldwide, not only in Australia.
And Constanza, which democracies are particularly vulnerable? Were you able to discern that?
So we conducted a study with over 170 countries, and our findings show that the effects of AI on the information systems is greater in those weaker democracies or countries that are considered to be autocratic, but democracies are also being affected, particularly on electoral years. When people are paying attention to politics, we see that democracies and very developed democracies such as Australia are also being impacted by these new technologies.
How so? Like, what actual functional role is it playing?
So we have different mechanisms, the effects of AI on the information systems and the spread of false information is one. Also, AI is amplifying the lower levels of trust on political institutions and politicians with the creation of deep fakes and dissemination of false news and artificial news. We also see that it's affecting how people are making decisions in two ways, either because they are directly affected by receiving false information and believing that this is true, but also because they might perceive that other voters are being affected. And as a result, in an indirect way, we will see that people trust electoral outcomes to a lesser extent. And also it has a great impact on trust in the government and on the electoral process overall.
Constanza, I struggle with this, I must admit, because I don't know whether it's discontent or distrust. I think that this word trust has come to be, I think, quite ill-used, and I think it can be, I find it quite confusing trying to work out the impact. So, and particularly that second thing, you said that it might make people think, well, how are other people reacting to this? Did I hear you correctly? And that augments their sense of, is it again disconnection? What is it? I don't quite understand.
So we observe different levels of anxiety when we ask respondents in Australia what they think about AI and their potential impact in the future as well. We see that among all the technologies that are being developed and scientific developments that we are seeing in our in these years, there is a major distrust on AI technologies. They are quite disruptive of the way.
So, a major distrust of AI technologies, is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Right, okay.
More than nuclear power, more than new nanotechnologies and all of that. That's on the one hand what's happening. And there is also an anxiety about the use of AI on a daily basis, how it's disrupting markets. And there is also an anxiety that is induced by the lack of regulation. So that creates a sort of vacuum by which people feel that the government is not doing enough.
That's worry about new technology, I suppose, coming, which I totally understand. I want to go back to some of your readings about democracies. Now, I notice in your coverage of established democracies, Hungary was the only country with a risk level of 5. Now, why is that? Was it because the government itself was using it? I mean, it's very much, you know, it's really an autocracy by any other name. I just found that quite intriguing.
So in the context of the European Union, we see that Hungary is the country with the highest level of risk. The country has experienced democratic backsliding and has shifted towards being an electoral autocracy. So the government was already censoring the media environment. There was harassment of journalists and intellectuals, so shrinking the space of communication. And now with these new technologies, we observe that the government is using this to also disseminate false information and biased information that could lead to increasing the support for the government against those that are not supporting what the government is doing and the ruling party.
And yet, in reality, we see that, you know, possibly Orban is in real bother with the electors, that they are turning against him. So maybe the people have seen through all this.
That is true. Although research also suggests that for voters, it's very difficult to identify what is true and false. Unfortunately, even the more educated voters sometimes have difficulties identifying what is false and not. What is, I think, the crucial question here is the magnitude of the pollution of the information ecosystem that can be done using these new technologies. So it can be done very fast, very efficiently, and also it can be used to target voters in the territory or overseas. So the effect is not going to be even across the electorate, but it could target specific groups. And so they are going to receive targeted information or false information that can then manipulate their behavior, but in terms of participation and depressed participation in elections, or also result on different choices at the ballot box. And this is what is very risky at the moment. And we do not have regulations, not in Australia, not in the context of the European Union, that are as elaborated to kind of mitigate the negative effects of these new technologies in electoral context yet.
So, Constanza, this is really interesting. It's making me think about two countries in particular. One is the Philippines, where we filmed for the TV series, The Matter of Facts, but also Indonesia, where there's very young voting populations that are incredibly engaged with social media. And so it would seem to me, and I think this has been borne out in recent elections in both countries, that social media and a fragmented information ecosystem has actually engaged young voters in a very powerful and enthusiastic way. And then on the flip side of it, a lot of this has replaced mainstream media, and you get this almost kind of tribal, influencer-driven narrative around electoral cycles. And then that's infused with things like AI. So in Indonesia, for example, Prabowo, who ultimately won, was sort of turned into a dancing cartoon character, cuddly grandfather version of someone that was actually an ex-military general. So how are you looking at those two cases?
When we break it down by the voting population and look at different social groups, we see that the younger voters are the most vulnerable at the moment to the spread of false information using these new tools, particularly because they consume a lot of social media. They try to seek information or political information during election campaigns online. And this is where these tools are being deployed. In addition, our data suggests that younger voters are more open to this new technology, so they're less skeptical to the negative impacts they might have.
And when you say being deployed, are you saying being deployed deliberately by the political parties, or it's other actors that are sort of inserting this material into the discourse?
We have both. We have domestic actors, so including candidates and political parties that are competing. We also have internal social groups that might be in the opposition and not competing for a particular election, but we also have evidence of foreign interference in the election. And this was pretty clear in recent elections all over the globe, that we had foreign forces, foreign actors interfering with different type of messages.
Can you give us an example of that? Like, what are foreign states doing? What are they inserting into the political discourse in another country, and why?
So there are specific political actors, social groups in Russia, for example, that have been shown to interfere in elections in Europe, with pro-Russian stances or negative stances regarding the ruling parties that are opposing the invasion of the Ukraine. So we have evidence for that. This interference is, again, not new. We have evidence for that for the last 15 years. But what is different this time is that these actors are able to penetrate more easily these information environments, and they're able to reproduce false information very fast. And so it's very difficult to understand what is real information and compared to false information, but also to understand what might be like foreign interference relative to real campaign information that has been distributed by political campaigners and political parties and candidates.
You're listening to our mini-series, The Matter of Facts, from Global Roaming on ABC Radio National. It's Hamish McDonald here, and I'm with
Geraldine Doogue, and we're listening to Constanza Sanhueza from ANU on Global Roaming.
Constanza, you mentioned right at the beginning that democracies are also not immune to this. How is a country like Australia being impacted, particularly by AI? And is it a sort of internal, a domestic, homegrown challenge, or is this stuff that's coming from outside?
A democracy like Australia, which is considered one of the most democratic countries in the world today, is not immune to the negative impact of this technology. And I think there are different mechanisms. The first one is because it induces a sort of anxiety in the population in terms of whether the government is doing enough, whether there are particular groups and political parties of the opposition or minorities manipulating public discourse. There's also an anxiety that whatever information we find online in debates and discussions might be biased in a way, and then might influence political representation because politicians might have the wrong perception of what the public opinion is. But at the same time, I think there is this kind of split in terms of where is the problem, right? And how it affects me versus how it affects other Australians, and whether maybe it's not affecting me directly because I'm able to distinguish what is real or the truth from false, but it might affect other more vulnerable parts of our society, and therefore you know, that decreases overall the level of trust on democracy and the democratic process. But I think there is an additional effect that we need to think about, and it's not particularly domestic. Australia is a country with a big share of the population coming from overseas or being second generation and speaking other languages than English at home. So what happens with this part of the population is that they might be more vulnerable to foreign messages and manipulation that is happening in other information ecosystems.
But you know, really, Constanza, the evidence, you know, over several elections is that efforts to target particular new migrant groups are often quite counterproductive. They become extremely, the evidence is they become very committed to the Australian way of election. They're actually super alert and report to others that somebody's trying to penetrate them. Like the notion that they're sort of vulnerable, sitting, waiting for, I don't think the evidence supports that at all.
No, I agree. It is true that voters of immigrant origin have a higher level of trust in democracy and in the government compared to voters that are born in the country. That is correct. However, we need to take into account that regulations that are done domestically in English-speaking environments might not be enough for a country that is multicultural and very diverse linguistically in that way. And so there might be other channels by which this information is spreading. And this is not unique to Australia. Again, we observe, for example, this communication in contexts like the German context and a lot of the German voters being of Russian origin and how information or false information is spreading in those Russian networks. Again, with the help of or the actions of these foreign forces, particularly based in Russia. So I think we need to take lessons from these other democracies and what is happening there to also look at our country domestically and what we should do to kind of really protect all social groups in the country.
Do you know, Constanza, sometimes I'm listening to you say all this, and I'm thinking that maybe one of the most important sort of ways to equip people is the ability to say to one's children or family, you know, when they present something to you and say, no, that just doesn't ring true. That just doesn't ring true. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, just basic skepticism born of good common sense. We must never lose that. Wouldn't you agree?
You haven't lost it, Jerry.
No, I know I haven't, but I certainly haven't. And I say to people, but I think there should be more, like I suspect we can fight back far more intelligently, Constanza, than is, you know, being mooted at the moment.
I agree. And I think we need to enhance public digital literacy. I mean, there was this great campaign that was developed here in Australia, the Stop and Consider. So, you know, approach every piece of information with a critical mind. I think the critical point here is the next generation, is our children and grandchildren, because we were educated in a world where we didn't have access to these technologies and we have to develop critical thinking and engage critically with content. But our children and grandchildren, they are being exposed to this and using these tools in a very critical way, you know, to facilitate also their learning, their performance at school, at universities. And so I think we have a clear task here that is helping the next generation engage more critically with democracy, with these technologies, and, you know, developing these skills and strengthening their understanding of, you know, the negative effects of false information as well.
Good. Well, that's you know, full permission to sound deeply skeptical. I shall pass it on to my grandchildren. Constanza, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Constanza.
Well, Hamish, she certainly had a lot to offer about, you know, about the impact on people watching elections, etc. I am hanging on, and you can hear it in my skepticism. I'm hanging on to the educated Australian public, I suppose.
Well, I also wonder, as we're having this and exploring this conversation together, I wonder if to some degree it's also based on what information ecosystem you exist within.
Mm.
You know, you're very much in the traditional media realm. you're of the ABC, you consume the ABC, the BBC, you read, you often read the physical newspapers. And I'm wondering if what you're describing is actually a symptom of the fact that we do all have quite different experiences of the information ecosystem, depending on how we consume it today.
I mean, I was thinking about a particular group that I'm invited to go and sit at their luncheon tables. And I have started to distrust, you know, I'm sort of completely concerned about this.
This word you said
this
you didn't
word
like.
That I'd, well, I've worked out what I mean, but I have started to distrust some of the people that they're inviting. But what it makes me do is turn elsewhere to seek what I do trust. So the idea that, so once you start to distrust, and this could be the case for a lot of people who do, doesn't mean that you then say, oh, it's all stuffed. Mm. You actually can turn to be more sure of other things.
Mm. Well, this is the thing they teach in Finland, right? This is the triangulation of information. So you receive the initial bit of information, could be word of mouth, could be on social media. It triggers something. So for you, you're kind of hyper aware of the things you're not quite sure about.
Hang on.
You've got
on.
A bit of curiosity there. And then you go away and you triangulate that information by finding other reliable sources. This is exactly what those interested in media and information literacy say we all have to develop the habit of doing.
Yes, to check ourselves and then to have the energy to go to something we do trust.
Absolutely. But in the first place, to know that if you are on social media, if you're on the internet and there's the little warning sign of, oh, hang on, I've got an emotional reaction to this. Is it real? Is that a fact? Mm. What this person, what they're saying to me, oh, that's making me feel a bit weird. Then having the knowledge, the insight that that is a warning and you do need to go and triangulate that information. Should we do a bit of feedback, Geraldine? Because we've had quite a lot on the first of our Matter of Facts mini-series, the interview with Marianne Wolfe.
Yes, Helen Moore came to us about our interview with Marianne Wolfe. She works as a volunteer for her professional association, mainly on policy matters and submissions. And Helen has been using ChatGPT and Claude quite a lot in preparing recent submissions, simply asking them to summarise or rework material I've written myself. At first, what comes up looks great. Then I start working through it closely and discover tiny but significant mistakes or misreadings. The only way I know their mistakes is because I have extensive expertise in the field. Now, I wonder at the implications for literacy teaching. What reading AI demands is intense, deep critical engagement based on alternative sources of knowledge. But where will the knowledge and skills come from that provides the basis for challenging what one reads or views?
It's a pretty good question,
I reckon. That's a very good question.
Another email we've had from Douglas Cole. Hi, Geraldine, Hamish and co. Congratulations on Matter of Facts episode today. A special high five for the forthcoming TV series. I'm currently in Sumatra, but look forward to seeing it on iView. G'day to you in Sumatra, Douglas. So he says, I very much share the fears of your guest about the dangers posed through misinformation and persuasion as AI assumes a major role in digital media. God help us. He says, the lack of trust in the international social media scene is bad enough already. It's awful to contemplate just how it will be used and abused by special interests with the AI tools now becoming available. And the billionaires who own the social sites have largely demonstrated that they couldn't care less. Sadly, the traditional information sources, newspapers, magazines, books and libraries won't stand a chance. Thanks for that uplifting final thought. Douglas in Pekanbaru in Sumatra. Global.roaming@abc.net.au is our email address. Please keep the feedback coming. We've got another instalment of our Matter of Facts mini-series coming up next week for you. And we're going to meet the founder and CEO of the Constructive Institute in Denmark, who's visiting Australia. And I know this really speaks to, I guess, one of your passions.
About the media's role, the media's responsibility. And, you know, is it a media that just stirs up fear or is it a media that offers where the answers might lie?
We're looking forward to sharing that with you next Monday. I'll be back tomorrow with Kylie. Thanks to our producers, Shane Anderson and Jesse Kay on this episode. Until next time, Jerry.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.